sitting and you're listening and not the footage.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another edition of Not the Footy Show, and it's coming to you remotely from two parts of Perth because we're still in isolation here. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee.
And we've got another good guest lined up for you today. We're catching up with Ron Smith, who used to be the coach at the AIS when it developed what was named the Golden Generation. He's also part of the FFA's new starting 11 that is going to try and revamp football and get it back on the right track in terms of development. So we thought it'd be good to catch up with him and find out what made the AIS such a success. And is it a romantic ideal if we think that by just reinstating it, suddenly we're going to produce talent again in this country? But, John, I believe yep. you're going to start us off today.
Yes. In the current climate, we've been hearing the word bailout a lot, Ashley. And it just got me thinking about what that means for sport. Does sport get a bailout from governments? And, of course, there's lots of ways to look at this because you've got community sport, the sort of sport that I play, and then you've got the professional sport with private ownership and those sorts of models. What are your thoughts? Is it the government's responsibility to bail sport out?
I think you've got to look at it almost on a case-by-case basis. My personal view is if it's a private enterprise, like the A-League clubs, which are privately owned, then absolutely categorically no. I think that, you know, those owners, it's their responsibility and the government should not be paying that. I also think, though, you need to look at the actual organisations, like what were their staffing levels, how much money did they make, bring in a year, how much did they set aside for situations like this, because we always know that something could happen that could cause, you know, a season to be delayed or a lack of funding to come through. And like any business or any householder, you have to plan for that day.
I find it interesting that in all of these discussions that we're hearing a lot from big name professional sports and the people that play them, and their big talking points at the moment are specifically about pay for players. And we're talking, you know, your sport we don't mention, cricket, soccer, rugby, all of the basketball to a degree, all of those big sports are having those conversations. The people we're not hearing from are Olympic athletes on AIS scholarships, people like that that get no money out of their sport anyway. How much support do we give those people?
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing I think kind of is sad. And I mean, you know, John, we've heard so many sports have bandied the words about like family, community, all of this. And you look at it and we're told that it's a big sporting family. And you think, well, okay, if it was exactly what you're saying now, some of the higher paid guys, but certainly if it was me, would be looking to help out guys in other sports or whatever. And you would, for the longevity of your sport, you would be taking a pay cut, or to save your club, you would be taking a pay cut. I find it, I mean, Roy Keane, the famous, you know, Irish and Manchester United footballer, he came out last week and said, no, why should you? You're contracted to be paid that amount of money. They should pay you that amount of money. Now, that's his view, and obviously everybody's got their own opinion. Mine is slightly different. I think the big thing is, again, you've got to look at the CEOs. I haven't heard of too many of the CEOs actually coming out publicly and saying that they're taking a cut, and we know that some of them are on ridiculous money, again, in my opinion, for what they actually do.
Well, let's divide the sports world into the haves and have-nots. And the have-nots are your Olympic-type sports, generally. And then the haves are the large professional sports. I would imagine that people who are government-subsidised to start with, such as hockey players or swimmers, those subsidies will continue. I imagine that they're still receiving whatever they would receive as if they were going through the normal motions, because that is the nature of the way that they're signed up to these things. They don't get paid super and any of that stuff that normal employees have. So they're on a slightly different wicket than everybody else. But it's not a substantial amount of money by any stretch of the imagination. Professional sports, as you say, you sign a contract. Well, how many of these contracts would have clauses in it that have something along the lines of, you know, a pandemic clause or the season can't be played clause?
Yeah, I would suspect not that many, to be honest.
Yeah, and it would be, and I'm sure that, you know, for every player, there's a different contract almost. And how much of a moral responsibility do the players have to say, well, we're not playing. If I was in any other job and I'm not working, I wouldn't get paid. And, you know, $1,500 a fortnight, they can always rely on that in this country.
No, exactly. I don't know. It's a really strange one, John. And I mean, the thing that as you know, we've kind of been harsh on some of the administrators. I know I have. I think that we've been top heavy in administration in a lot of sports, certainly top heavy in management in a lot of sports. And I don't know if you saw the press release that came out from Sports West. And I found this quite scary. This was from Rob Thompson. And he said that the impact on winter sport to date was 735,812 participants have been impacted. Now, that's players, coaches, and officials. He then said 118,827 administrators and volunteers had been affected. Now, I find that figure terrifying, because if you actually look at that, that means for every participant, which is a player, coach, or an official, for every 6.19 participants, there's an administrator.
Yeah.
That is ridiculous.
Well, they also crouch that in administrators and volunteers, don't they, which are obviously completely separate categories. Why would you count them together?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, volunteers don't get paid a cent, administrators. But, I mean, you look at that and you think it's still a staggering amount of number of people that are assisting for just 6 participants. It's crazy.
Yeah, and I think you'd find most of that paid participant group would be at the top end, you'd expect, and the volunteers are coming from the grassroots areas.
Exactly, yeah. So where the greatest participation is, we've probably got the least administration, but the most volunteers. And yet where the least participation, we've got the most administrators. And I just hope when we come out the other side of this that the structures and the management structures and the administrative structures are all reviewed. And I think there needs to be a working party that goes into each organisation that gets government funding and looks at it and says, no, you can't do it that way anymore. You need to streamline it. You need to do it better. And actually maybe give them business guidance, because, as we know, some of these people actually do not come from a business background, so have never worked in a proper business environment. They've either come from politics or working in the government.
Yeah.
Or they've actually just got a sports management degree, which I'm afraid I don't have a lot of time for. I don't think they teach you a great deal on those.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. I, in the end, think that, you know, the general level of whinging from the large sports will see them get a hefty amount of government money. Even though these are sports that signed, you know, billion-dollar television rights deals and stuff, and I think some of the participants will start to ask questions about where the money actually goes if we have to go cap in hand to a government to get money to keep us solvent.
No, absolutely. I think it's a worry to me. I think, you know, where we're at and the situation we find ourselves in, and I think there's been a lot of people that have been on the gravy train, but I think now things have to change. And we've also got to shift that focus to look after the majority rather than the minority.
Hi, I'm Zocco Kallitz, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as we said at the top of the show, we've got a great guest lined up for you. And we're going to catch up now with Ron Smith. Now, Ron Smith was the coach of the AIS. He was also coach of the Perth Glory and is now part of the FFA's starting 11. Now, a lot of the golden generation have been talking about reinstating the AIS, a program that many of them came through and that they believe helped them go over to Europe and become the footballers they became. And so we thought it was really appropriate to catch up with Ron and find out whether this was feasible or the game has moved on and there's no chance of possibly recreating it the way it was. Well, Ron Smith, welcome back to Not the Footy Show.
Thank you. Nice to be back again.
Well, it's been a while since we caught up, but I just thought it was worth catching up with you because obviously a lot of the golden generation, and in particular Mark Viduka, have been talking about bringing back the AIS. Now, I thought we would look at that because obviously you were heavily involved in that. But first of all, I just wondered, you know, what was it that made the AIS so successful in that time?
In a nutshell, Ashley, it was the closest you'll ever get to being a full-time professional footballer or an apprentice professional footballer, I should say. And we had great facilities that, and a program that was all encompassing. And on top of that, the players got to train and play far more than they ever would have in clubland. And we're also exposed to international football as part of that program. And, you know, you put all of that together and it's just conducive to helping people develop whatever potential they've got. And, you know, and also the other major factor was that we had most of the best players in the country there, all training together.
Yeah, I mean, a phrase I've heard from some of those players who went through that system is they all said, you know, a lot of them were connected to NSL clubs, but they said when they came to you, it was almost like a finishing school and you were polishing the diamond.
Yeah, that's a good, I mean, I said this, I was asked about this last week, and I said that the talent ID process actually started when kids were 13 and 14 years of age. That's where we got to in the end. It wasn't always like that. But once the state institutes came on board in the early 90s, and Perth was the first, actually. Ron Tindall had the first waste program, and that was in 91 or 92. Most of the others came along 92, 93. But that gave us an opportunity then to start a talent ID program that was first of all geared towards the Joey's age group. And then out of the Joey's, the ones that we thought might have a good chance of playing at youth as well, they had an opportunity to come into the AIS in the second year of a 2-year cycle. But our primary focus wasn't on the Joey's age group. It was on the kids that were born in the odd year, or if you like, a year older. So there were two distinct programs. The State Institutes was set up to identify and help develop talent. And so in that way, we could start bringing younger players even than the Joeys into that program as an early start. So, for example, Vinny Grella was at the VIS as 13-year-old, even though he was a Joey. But, you know, so what I'm saying is that the state institutes, their main focus was on the boys born in the even year who would play at under 17 level. But we, you know, we said, don't put all of the players in that age group because we've got 6 programs around the country. So we're only going to pick 20 kids in the squad out of 120 anyway. So the odds are you're going to have your best 20 to 30 players from whichever state they come, but use the others for some that are a little bit older, that are in the current AIS age group, but we couldn't bring in because we only had 18 scholarships, and start with some that are even younger to get them into a training program that went virtually 11 months of the year, and also the benefit of training with good older players, even though they're only 15. You know, so it ticked an awful lot of boxes, the system that we had in place. And you know, continued for over 2 decades in that format.
Now, obviously, we hear of the success and we look at the players that came through that program and were successful. I'm sure there were some that didn't make it to the top level because you always get that. But I mean, what were the main issues that you had at that time? Because it can't all have been plain sailing as the romantics today seem to make it out to be.
Yeah, that's very true, Ash. And there were a lot of occasions. The biggest challenge we had was balancing the level of competition. And this is always the biggest problem that anyone will have in a developmental program. How do you match the level of competition with the technical and tactical ability and physical development of young players? The temptation is to try and put them into senior football or against tougher competition. And the danger there is that if it's a little bit too tough, you're on the back foot all the time and you may cop some hidings. And if that happens on a regular basis, I don't think that does anything for the development. Because in teaching people about playing football, you want to be able to be in a situation where you can learn to control the game and be dominant in your possession. And equally, you need to experience being dominated so that you can learn how to survive, because it's going to happen, right? So finding that blend, and, you know, over a season, you will probably find there'll be some games where you may be on top and in control more than others, and it will depend where you are. So to clarify that, in our first year of playing in the National Youth League, which was for boys 2 years older, plus they could have four overage players, when we first had a new intake come in, it was a real battle. Okay, but because we had really good quality kids, we could survive in it. You know, it was like, and they weren't all as strong as a Marconi or Sydney United, you know, who would put in their four overage players because they were always desperate to beat us, which was great. Yeah. You know, and that thing, they had good youth players who were older than our boys. So the cycle of events was that, let's say you were the coach at Marconi, then all the players in your squad could potentially be in the current Youth World Cup age group, which was under 20. Whereas we had the squad for the next World Cup, which was 16 to 18. And because of that, the clubs were happy to support the program because by and large, they were going to get the kids back. They didn't have a competition for 16. Okay, there'd be one or two 16, 17-year-olds that were in that youth side, you know, playing up age groups, but the bulk of them were all between the under 18 to 20 age group plus four overage. So it all fitted in very nicely. Now, you can imagine then, after 18 months, we were becoming more and more dominant in that league, you see. So what I tried year after year after year to say, if we upped our age group 1 year, so instead of bringing them in at 16, we brought them in at 17, why couldn't we play in something like the New South Wales Premier League, the New South Wales State League, which now all the A-League teams play in?
Yep.
But we couldn't, that was our biggest challenge. We couldn't get approval for that to happen from the clubs. And obviously you'd be aware of the political backgrounds and criteria for programs. The government move the goalposts every few years and say, well, if we're going to fund development programs, they have to flow into a national junior team. And if there's a gap of 12 months, well, it doesn't fit the criteria. So you either can the program or you're going to have to change. You know, so all that was always going on in the background. And we looked a number of times for this reason. We looked at lowering the age group to make our program fit in with the Joeys rather than the under 20 squad, because our boys left us, went and played in the NSL and then played in the World Cup qualifiers. You know, sometimes more than 12 months after leaving our program. So when the boys were playing in the Youth World Cup qualifiers, they were all first team players in the NSL. But that was part of the process. It started at 14 years of age in a state institute, flowed through into the AIS for 2 years, out into the NSL. And so, you know, so it was a period of preparation that was really over 5 to 6 years, not just two.
Looking at that, you mentioned that we've got now the A-League clubs have got teams playing in the National Premier Leagues around the country. If you look at that, it's a diluted sort of program from what you were talking about, where you had the cream of the crop that were at the AIS playing in one league. Do you think that this is working with the A-League clubs playing in the NPL, or is it not working? Because, again, I've seen players who've got demoralized because they haven't gone as well, you know, in certain grades, because exactly the points you say, they're younger, they're not physically strong enough, and they're playing against men.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, Ash, about finding the right level of competition. And as I said earlier, it is the biggest challenge you always face in any kind of development program. But what I would say is that whenever, let's take the AIS out of the equation, and we always had NSL clubs, which was our top level. Now they've been replaced by A-League clubs, but they're still our clubs at the top level. Okay. And so, however many you have and however many players they cater for, you don't have the best with the best. You know, that's just a fact. Now the A-League clubs now with their youth teams are trying to find the best kids they can within an area or within a state. I mean, WA, has got, you know, the ideal situation where they've got one club. So any kids are going to want to aspire to play for Perth Glory first and foremost if they don't go overseas. Now the opportunities they may get. Okay. Now that's a whole different ball game, but in terms of being able to provide something, in conjunction with what member federations can do, I think that's the key. I'm not sure that making the A-League clubs responsible for everything in football is the right way to go, because I don't think they have the resources to do it.
I don't I
think if you look historically at football all over the world, clubs are where kids play. And they stay there and they go in the first team, then they get transferred, whatever. That's the system that happens all over the world. Okay. Along the way, there are teams for representative football. They're organized by maybe county associations or state federations and then national associations. Hence, we have under 16 World Cup qualifiers through Asia. It's a part of the world where you all compete, and three or four teams go to the FIFA World Cup finals of whatever age group the following year. So you have this process, which is deemed desirable because it's giving kids an experience of what they may have later in life, going to play in things like the Olympic Games or World Cups and so on and so on. Now, if we don't worry about international football, well, we don't need national teams. But how boring would that be if we only have domestic leagues? Yeah. You know, so, and this has happened. I mean, and look at the, going a little bit off track here, but it wasn't so long ago when many of our national team players were punished severely for playing for Australia. I mean, you know Dave Mitchell very well, and Mitch lost his playing career at Feyenoord because he actually said, "It's in my contract, I can play for Australia, I'm going to play." And they said to him, basically, "Well, if you do, we're going to replace you."
Yep.
And that's what happened. So he gave up his professional career. And how sad is that?
That's terrible. You know,
when push came to shove, FIFA suddenly said, "Hang on, we won't have a World Cup soon because the clubs are going to dictate who's going to play where." And so, obviously, for the good of the game, people got their heads together and said, "We will create World Cup windows." And so there's no club competitions, and the clubs, they have to release the players a minimum of 3 days before a game, I think it is, unless it's changed. You know, so it's quite clear where the player's loyalties lie. But if you're a player, you'd want to play in a World Cup. You'd want to play for your country. You know, it's the greatest honour you can get. So why would you deprive players of that? You know, so, and these things have evolved over time.
Yeah.
We've got a little bit off track there, but, you know, it comes back to people having this desire to get the best players together to play and represent the country or state. And I think that that's a real motivator for young people. My motivation as a kid growing up was I wanted to play for Tottenham. And I, you know, the thought of playing for England never entered my head because unless you got to play for Tottenham, well, the other was just a pipe dream. And it was hard enough in those days to play for a big club.
Absolutely.
And unfortunately, I grew up where there were only big clubs. And usually the only kids that played for big clubs were junior schoolboy internationals. So, yeah, it was a battle.
Yeah, just going back, though, to this idea of reinventing the AIS. Now, obviously, it had it, as you've touched on there, it had its place in that time. Things have evolved now. We've got the A-League instead of the NSL. We've got different structures. Some would say we've got a better administration than we had in those days. But is it almost, do you believe that we could recreate something? Or is it foolish to think that, you know, we could suddenly go, here's the AIS again, and it's going to produce the same results?
Yeah, I think that's that is a bit of wishful thinking because the whole landscape's changed and so has the attitude of everybody in football.
Totally agree.
They generally hate going back because they think it's a retrograde step. And in many respects, you'd say, yeah, that's right. But what I think is that if you look at the principles that helped produce players, what were they? And so the more you try and do the same program for everybody across the country, the bigger the problem gets. If you try and do things to help a select group of players, A, it's not so expensive. It's nowhere near demanding in terms of staffing. And so it becomes a little bit more achievable. And so what I would say is that you may not ever get a program now where you've got the best with the best in residence for a period of time, but you may be able to have programs where the best are identified and brought together for special camps. When I think back, when the under 17 squads used to have camps at the AIS, they were almost monthly. So I was there with the youth age. Fully yeah. Residential, and that was also to look after education. That was a top priority, that we help kids with their education, whatever they aspired to. And hand on heart, I can honestly say, any boys that came in who said, and I spoke to parents on a regular basis, anyone came in and said, my son has always wanted to go to university, they got there. Okay, because they had tutorial support, even though they were training eight, nine times a week for long periods during the course of the year. Their time management was critical. And most of the boys were motivated. So they looked after themselves. They got help when they needed it. And they didn't waste any time traveling. So whereas, you know, now you've got kids who have to travel, you know, 2 to 3 hours a day just to get to training. That could all be studying.
Yeah,
but it isn't in a car. So you see, they're the benefits. So there's pros and cons. So I think what we need to do is to say, if you had a group of people, and they may not all be in the same age group, but if you had a view and you said, all right, we've got 12 lads here, or let's say 16, so that you could bring them together and train and do some, you could do a lot of stuff off the park in terms of sports psychology, nutrition and all those sorts of areas where it's not about playing, it's about education. Making people aware of all sorts of things and have some training where you can try and, you know, develop those players, linked to what national coaches are trying to achieve when they bring the boys together. I think, you know, we just need to explore things that we're not doing right now instead of having none. So we've gone from 2 year or 12 to 24 months at the AIS in residence, training 8-9 times a week, playing games all year round, to now we've only got club football.
Yeah.
It's nothing for the kids unless they're picked in the national squad and they have maybe 3 camps during the year.
Well, hopefully, you know, this new first 11 that James Johnson's put together is going to workshop all those ideas and come up with something. You're part of that. But one of the things I look at again is if we look, you know, the A-League clubs have to have 3 sort of underage players or under 23 players. And so many of these players we see then released after, say, 2 years or even a year. You've touched on their identifying talent. Clearly, these players are being identified as having talent, but then they're lost to the system. I mean, to me, I think we almost need, if we're going to stick to that plan, like Glenn Hoddle's second chance, where, you know, he picks up the players that have been released from the professional thing, work on their weaknesses to make them better, to get them back into the system.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that. I remember seeing a program where Glenn Hoddle was interviewed and so on. But just to digress slightly, the idea of having 3 under 20 players on the roster was introduced by Ange when he was the national youth coach when the A-League kicked off. Because he said then, unless we make some provision, even if it's they're not getting much game time, they're training with senior players, they're in that environment, that's got to be good for the development of players who are going to go into playing in the under 20 World Cup. So that was why it was introduced in the first place. Now, I don't think legislation works. A similar idea was implemented when I was coaching in the M League in Malaysia. We had to have 3 under 23 players on our roster. In fact, they had to be on the team sheet. It wasn't just in the roster. In clubs I coached, we'd have 23 to 25 players in the first team squad. Now, three of those players at least had to be under 23. Sometimes there were more, but 3 of those had to be on the team sheet. Now, they didn't play much, I can tell you that.
Yeah.
Because there were better players who were older, and the coaches, they survive on results. And it's okay being, you know, philosophical about player development and everything else. But the bottom line is, if you lose, you're out, you're finished. You might never coach again. And so you can understand why coaches do everything they can to win. And if you look at the success in the A-League, the more mature your squad, the greater chance that you've got of being successful. And that's been proven over and over by 4 or 5 successful coaches in the A-League. No one's done anything with a young squad other than battle. So, you know, there are clear messages. And there are examples where coaches have worked in the A-League. They get sacked and that's it. They disappear off the radar, having spent maybe 10 or 12 years and upwards of $20,000 or $25,000 on accreditation programs to get that chance. And then, boom, it's gone in a few months, never to surface again. You know, we throw coaches out like the garbage on a regular basis.
Yeah, it's not just players. You
know, no, exactly, no. The PFA actually look after players. Nobody looks after coaches, mate. It's a dog-eat-dog world. And I know that from my own experiences. But, you know, you go into it with your eyes open. You know, if I'm not successful, I'm going to get sacked. It's just a question of when. I mean, the old saying, you know, there's only 2 types of coaches, those that have been sacked and those that are going to be.
Absolutely. And you're not a good coach until you've been sacked, they say. So there you go. Look, Ron, it's been brilliant catching up with you. I know we could have talked for a lot, lot longer, but hopefully we've covered some of the facts and the challenges facing a sort of reinvention of the AIS anyway.
Yeah, well, like I say, times change, Ashley. My honest opinion is that we need a compromise all along. Clubs need to acknowledge that they might have two of the best players or three of the best players in a particular age group, and we need to do something for those over and above what the club's doing. That would be my view. And I think if there's a shared feeling about the development process, that it's not just about, you know, the club. And this has been done in other countries where coaches have gone into clubs to work with people who've been identified as potential national teams. It was done in Scandinavia years ago. And because it was so successful, the club started to actually ask the coaches to come in and work with more players. And then it led to specialist coaches just working with, you know, the players that they thought really had what it would take to go all the way. Again, can't do anything in isolation. It has to be a cooperative approach. And that means then you need to spend time talking about it and coming up with ways of implementing things so that everybody gets what they want out of it.
Well, Ron, let's hope you guys and the first 11 can put that together. But we wish you all the best, and thanks again for your time today.
No worries. My pleasure.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here. You're listening to Not The Footy Show.
You are indeed listening to Not The Footy Show. And that was Ron Smith, the former coach of the RAS and the Perth Glory. And he's a very experienced coach, as you can probably tell from what he was saying there. And in fact, if you want more information from Ron, you can go to his website, which is thefootballcentre.com.au. And I think that's, what's that, a chook in the background there, John?
No, nothing here.
Okay. But Ron made some interesting points there in, obviously, that the AIS, the way it was, John, you can't go back to it because the game has moved on, the structure of the game. We've got a new administrative body. We've got a new league as opposed to the NSL. But I think that there is probably room for change. I think there is definitely, it was a program that worked, and I think they've just got to maybe look at how they can tweak it, bring it back. One of the big things I think that the FFA made a mistake in was reducing the age limits. So that what happened was the last sort of intakes that went to the AIS, they weren't ready to go straight back to their A-League clubs and play for them, which is the difference when, you know, Ron and the likes of your Vidukas and Lucas Neils were coming through. They then went back and played in, you know, the NSL sides.
Where does the responsibility lie for developing juniors? And I imagine it's different for each sport, but let's talk specifically about football, soccer. Where does that responsibility lie?
Well, this is a big question at the moment. So when it became the FFA, they brought in these programs that every club had to have junior setups, which personally I don't agree with because I think you find sport evolves naturally. There are some clubs that are developing clubs. There are some clubs that always just buy talent and try to win stuff by doing it that way and are not very good at developing them. But then they try to bring in that obviously all of the A-League clubs had to have youth components as well. So what we've seen though is the whole market disrupted because suddenly the local clubs who've maybe invested in this child for a long time lose them when they get to 14, 15 because the A-League club snaps them up. Mum and dad thinks that, ooh, wow, my son's going to play in the A-League. He's going to then go overseas and make us lots of money. And of course, the reality is none of that's going to happen. And I don't think it's actually helping the development. So what you're finding is some of the children that are picked up by the Glory youth teams, because they've got that dream of playing the A-League, then when they drop out of that, they walk away from the game. They've got no love of the game. And I think we've got to instill, as we talked to Alex Chiat the other week, or Chiat, I think his name is pronounced properly, my apologies. You know, you have to give children enjoyment of sport. If they enjoy it, they'll go and practice on their own. If they enjoy it, they'll grab some mates and go and play in the park. And we don't see that today. And I think it's become too regimented. It's become
too much about this pathway to being a professional, which very few of them will ever be on.
Do you think that, say, in a situation like the A-League, clubs would be better served by having, say, a seconds team or a reserves team as opposed to a junior team?
Yeah, well, the clubs do have, you know, reserve teams, but there are restrictions on that. So, and it was interesting talking to Ron, this point that they introduced into the NPL. So depending on how your age, depending on how long you've been at the club, you're only allowed to put so many points. Each player is awarded points depending on whether they've been juniors or that. And you're not picking the best team. So, again, the quality is diluted. You should always, by all means, have, you know, quota systems with age and all of that in squads, but to bring players through. But your first team has to be the best 11 players or the best, you know, 14 players if you've got three substitutes. I mean, I know you're allowed five on the bench, but, you know, to me, if you want the league to be a success and you want your players to develop, the best players have to be playing and they have to be playing against the best players.
See, for mind, all sports had, before the, say, the 1990s, all sports had their own pathways. And the pathway was you're a junior. If you're good enough, you got to go, you know, you played seniors early, but you generally didn't play seniors until you were of that age group. And the cream always rose. We always had good players. There's no question a bloke like Puskas couldn't have played today. I mean, I don't know that players are any better now than they ever were before. They might train more and do all that sort of stuff, but their inner core and skill as a player is no better, I don't think. And I'm wondering if we shouldn't maybe go back and revisit some of those models from yesteryear and perhaps that they were the way to really develop juniors and not these specialised programs.
I totally agree with you. I think I'm always been a believer if you're good enough, you're old enough. And if you look at you take the sport that you love, John, hockey, yeah. And if you look at the amount of players that come from country areas around Australia that are playing for the Kookaburras and the Hockey Roots. Now, some of them, if you talk to them, they will tell you this, because they're playing in the country area, they don't have necessarily so many people. So if they're younger, they get the chance to play in the senior team a lot earlier. And then Jamie Dwyer is a prime example. He said to me personally that, you know, he developed his skills. He's not a very big man now. He's not the tallest. He's not the physically the most strong. But he said he learned to develop his skills so that he could beat bigger men and men that were maybe more skillful at that time. He beat them with his skill, and he had to develop that side of his game, which made him, you know, five times world player of the year.
And physically as well. I don't think it's just a skill thing. Guys that are just physically stronger and you can't push them off the ball or do that sort of stuff that maybe you could as a junior.
Absolutely. You know, that's where you learn how to ride a tackle and how to roll a player and how to, you know, you can't match them physically. So you have to develop a skill yourself to be able to compete with someone who's bigger than you physically and stronger than you.
Yeah, or developing the skills that you do have, the natural advantages that whatever your body type is gives you, and also developing skills that allow you to take on those things that you're deficient at, where other people, because of their bodily size, might have an advantage over you. And remember, short guys have certain advantages over tall guys, and tall guys have a different set of advantages over short guys.
But that's just one area. It is. I mean, John, you've got this ridiculous situation now where, you know, kids are turning up, say, for trials with Premier League clubs, and if they're not a certain height, they're just told, see you later, you're not going to make it. And that's just ludicrous. I mean, luckily Barcelona didn't do that with Lionel Messi, you know, yeah. But there are fantastically talented players who are small or diminutive and in size and stature, but they have the skills. And I think what we're seeing as well, by losing some of these players that have learned these skills to develop, we're losing a lot of the characters. I get really frustrated when I hear a coach tell a player off and tell him he must play the way he's facing. If he's shown a bit of brilliance to beat a defender, get the right side of him and whip in a good cross. And to me, it's just we're losing that because it's becoming too automated, too regimented, And I think that's why the crowds are staying away in some sports, because there's no excitement. There's no character.
Oh, look, I think an underthought about side of junior development too is umpiring, but we'll leave that for another day because that could go on quite a while.
It probably could, but I think it's an area that clearly the FFA have realised that they've got to sort this out, because at the moment it's going nowhere. The Australian team, they did qualify for the Junior World Cup recently with Graham Arnold, and congratulations to all those players. But up until that point, we'd had a real problem and we weren't succeeding. And so, you know, it needed to be reviewed. I'm not a fan of this, the NPL structure. I've fought against it. I put my hand up and, you know, we talked about it for a long time. It had failed in the Netherlands. Why we ever accepted it and thought it was going to work is beyond me. And I just think the pathway system, I hate the word pathway. I'm with you. Let players play at their clubs with their mates, develop, let the clubs develop them. And then we'll see if they're good enough, then they get selected to go on to another level. And that's the way it should be, rather than trying to streamline them through one particular, sort of course of action.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, John, it's been good catching up again, and we'll no doubt speak again soon.
Yes, definitely. Perhaps we'll even get the opportunity to speak face-to-face.
I think we probably will now, because obviously in Western Australia we're very lucky that the restrictions are being lifted, but as long as we're a metre and a half away, we should be okay.
Just the other day I was looking up at the globe that I have on my shelf here, Ashley, and you know what? It's not a bad thing that we're miles and miles and miles away from nothing.
No, this has been one of the times where it's certainly been to our advantage. And our thoughts do go out to everybody around the world who's listening to this. And we do, I know, have people that download it in all parts of the world. And we hope that you're safe and getting through your periods of isolation and everything can get back to normal as soon as possible, and especially the sporting landscape.
Oh, I'll tell you what, I could do with a run. I'm feeling it.
There's nothing stopping you doing that, John.
No, well, there is, because I only run when I've got a stick and there's other people with a ball.
Well, you could always take a stick for a run.
Some people say I'm a running stick, mate.
Oh, that's perfect.
Some people are on the bench. They think it's all over. It gets
done. See ya. We'll be back next week.